I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to the Irish Country Living Podcast. Hello, and welcome back to the Irish Country Living Podcast. I'm your host, Anne O'Donoghue. This week, have I got a treat for you. I have an interview with the one and only Mr. Professor Luke O'Neill. Mr. and Professor. All the titles in there for Luke. Recently, our photographer, Philip Doyle, and I went to Trinity to meet Luke. And Philip and I, over the years, would have got to meet a lot of high-profile people. But both of us, before this, we were absolutely buzzing. And I suppose that's because Luke has been so steadfast throughout the pandemic and also so positive when we need it most. So you'll hear Phil throughout the interview as well in there. But we speak about overcoming COVID. We speak about farmers' immunity. Farmers have got good immunity, so that's good news. His band, the Metabolics, and also the importance of good teachers. So without further ado, let's get into it, shall we?
Up in vain, probably, for
God bless you.
Before I started.
I'm going to give you a multiple choice question. Make sure listening.
It's been a long time now since I was in college. But immunology kind of was discovered by a farmer. Am I correct in saying that?
And the vaccines?
Well, yeah, with relation to smallpox and the milkmaid.
The very first vaccine, yes, was this guy, Edward Jenner. But there was a guy called Jesty, Benjamin Jesty, who was a farmer.
Yeah.
And there was an old wives' tale anyway, going around for 100 years, that milkmaids didn't get smallpox. And that was kind of well known as a folk type thing.
Yeah.
And milkmaids were famous for smooth skin, you see, because they were getting all the pock marks. And Jesty, he tried it first. So this is the strange part. He took some cowpox blister off a woman, milkmaid, gave it to someone, and then said there was evidence of stopping smallpox. But the trouble is, he didn't do it as extensively or as rigorously, should we say, as Jenner. So Jenner was the first to do a real trial. And he got this milkmaid called Sarah Nelms. This is on my podcast, man, if you listen to this week's podcast. So Sarah Nelms is her name, right? She was a milkmaid. He took a blister from her, some pus off a blister from her, gave it to a boy called James Phipps, okay? And then didn't give him smallpox, but gave him, it gets a bit complicated already. There was evidence, if you take fluid off a smallpox person and give that to someone else, that can protect them. But they get a bit of it, they get a few symptoms because they've been given a bit of smallpox. He gave that to James Phipps, didn't get any symptoms. And he thought, oh, this must be preventing then smallpox from harming people, you know? And then he did a trial with maybe 11 people, I think, in the end, his own baby. Can you believe it? That's how confident he was. And they were all protected, right? And then they begin to use it widely in England. But it's true. It begins on a farm with Jesty. Now, Jesty was... Jenner becomes famous then. And he gets loads of money off the UK, the government, to reward him and all that. And Napoleon said he was a great guy. The Empress of Russia sent him a diamond. And he said that. Now, Jesty begins to resent this.
Of course.
And he contacts the Houses of Parliament. He goes, I need recognition. And they gave him a golden lancet. They gave him a special gift of a golden lancet. Isn't that amazing?
So he got something in the end.
He did in the end, yeah. But he was a bit sort of saying, that was my idea. You know, the other guy ripped me off. And which may be partly true because Jesse's farm was near where Jenna was. Yeah. So they're in Gloucestershire, I think, in England. So.
And even though it's a great story and all, and we don't know what's true and what's not, but
yeah.
Is the essence of it in terms of farmers having good immune systems true, as in being exposed to dirt in the environments that they're
that's
in?
That's true as well.
Obviously, the game has changed a bit with regard to being more hygienic now, but is that true that the more you're exposed to dirt, the more.
Definitely. And they've even done studies of putting people onto a farm for a month, say, and it will protect them against asthma later in life. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
So there's something in farms that protect people against allergy and asthma mainly, you know. And they call it the hygiene hypothesis. So a bit of dirt's good for you, basically.
Yeah.
It's probably something in the dung, really. There's some bacteria there that you're inhaling, you know. And if you get exposed to that, what happens there is, if you're young, especially if you're a child or a baby, actually, if your immune system is exposed to a bit of dirt, it teaches it how to tell friend from foe, you know. If you don't have that, you're going to be hyper sensitive then sometimes, and that's what allergy asthma is. You inhale something and you get a big allergic reaction, you know. So yeah, so being on a farm is good for you, basically. And then secondly, outdoors is great, you know, fresh air helps, the sunlight, all those things, you know. But a bit of dirt's not bad. Yeah,
okay, so a bit of dirt is good. You don't have to clean the house too much.
No, don't be overzealous with the cleaning. And in COVID times now, it turns out surfaces aren't that big a risk.
Okay, so initially we all were kind of the 99.9% bacteria spray and all the scrubbing. It's not as
I bet that they'll change their recommendation on that, maybe. They haven't yet. I mean, there is a risk from surfaces, let's make that clear. But the early studies were a bit done, I suppose, what's the word, overzealously. They were putting huge amounts of virus on a surface, and then they get detected later, you know.
Yeah.
If you cough on a surface, it's tiny amounts, you know. Yeah. So the chance of getting infected is very low. The main transmission is person to person. That's for definite.
And just kind of in that, we're talking about, I suppose, COVID and the changing of, you know, the recommendations and things like that.
Yep.
In years to come, Luke, will it just be a disease that we manage? Will it be an endemic?
Yeah, definitely.
And will we have way more medicine to be able to deal with it? It'll just be something that's manageable.
Exactly. It'll become, after the vaccination campaign, it'll become like the flu, really, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Every winter, we'll vaccinate the vulnerable, you know. We may vaccinate children as well, just for them to build up immunity, you know, but the rest of us won't get vaccinated, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The reason why there's mass vaccination happening now is to get rid of the virus. Because you got to get 80% of us vaccinated, the virus can nowhere to go, you know. And then once we've got it under control, there will be spikes every so often, just like every winter we've outbreaks of flus and colds. It's in the same family as a cold virus, you see. So it'll become like one of them in the end, you know. And as long as we've got the vaccinations available, that'll protect people.
And you've spoken a bit recently, I suppose, about reasons to be hopeful and things like that, and everyone's kind of clinging to that like they do.
Yeah.
Is there reason to be hopeful?
Oh, absolutely, no question. I mean, there's spectacular science happening around. I mean, we now have the very unusual position of an embarrassment of riches when it comes to vaccines. There's 3 approved now in Ireland, right? There will be at least 5 approved in the coming months. Huge number of vaccines. We know the vaccines work. We know they protect people. All the vaccines, by the way, will stop you ending up in hospital and getting really sick for definite. All of them do that, including AstraZeneca. So there you have it. I mean, this is great. I think we've turned a huge corner in the past, say, month because of the vaccination campaign. And the good news is in Israel, they're ahead of us now. They've been vaccinating massively.
Yes.
I think they've half their people vaccinated. The evidence is there. Decrease in death rate, decrease in hospital, especially over 60s because they went out for the older people first. So again, we can be very hopeful now that this vaccination campaign will give us the answer we're looking for in a way.
And from a purely scientific and immunology point of view in COVID, has it been a kind of to study it, research it, and to be at one stage you were doing research in COVID?
Oh, we are still, like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
is it kind of a once in a lifetime thing for a scientist like yourself to be able to, you know, be researching this and look kind of, I suppose, trying to figure it out? And
well, before COVID, we were doing lots of stuff anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we worked on other viruses in my lab, for instance, over the years. Now my main area, though, is inflammatory diseases, so I work on inflammation. And inflammation can happen in your lungs, in your brain, in your skin, with things like psoriasis, say, or asthma, or even Alzheimer's. They're all inflammatory. And COVID is an inflammatory disease. It makes your lungs very inflamed, you see?
Yeah.
So my lab could easily then switch, and we've got 4 projects now trying to suppress the damage. In other words, there's 2 ways to treat COVID. One is to vaccinate, and that stops you getting infected. That's great.
Yeah.
But some people still get infected and still have problems. That's my end of the business, to treat them in hospital and come up with new ways of saving them, I suppose, from the inflammatory consequences. And we'll still need that, remember, because it'll take quite a while to vaccinate everybody. Some don't respond to the vaccine, small numbers. So, And even now we have people in hospital with the flu, you know. So again, my area is trying to develop new ways to come up with medicines to treat people who get sick. Now, is it a once in a lifetime? Well, we've been doing this for years, so it's funny, the focus is on us, and we're saying, well, you didn't, no interest a year ago, did you?
So you're in vogue now at the minute.
Well, yeah,
with the general people who, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it's not a bad thing. I mean, I've always been trying to get, one of my missions is to get science in the media anyway, because it's a great thing to tell people about, you know, especially kids, that they might be inspired to be scientists, you know, so that's all a part of it. I suppose what I'd say has happened is it's got more intense, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
We got to go fast now, haven't we? We got to come up with solutions. And not just my lab, but all the immunology labs. Like in Trinity, there's a consortium of 14 labs now working together. We have a COVID-19 centre, so we're all collaborating on this, you know. So it's got a bit more vivid, maybe the word, you know. And I think the big thing to say would be this, by the way. Whatever we discover about COVID could apply to other diseases. So if we found a drug to block inflammation in lungs for COVID, that could work for asthma, or it could work for COPD. And certainly we desperately need new ways to stop infections in hospitals. Remember, people still die of sepsis in hospitals, even those antibiotics, you know. So what I'm saying is, even though there may well be treatments for an infectious disease, but some people still get sick, and our end of it is to try to help them, you know, in a sense.
Yeah. And we were speaking earlier, and you kind of touched on it there, I suppose, especially with young people, and making science relatable.
Yeah.
I suppose we were just saying as well how popular you've become, and how people so want to hear from you and hear what you think and your opinions. Do you think that making science relatable is really important in terms, I suppose, of encouraging young people into it and making it accessible to the ordinary person?
Well, I think, see, from my point of view, and again, I'm a zealot, so watch this one. Science is great. It's a great thing to do. I mean, it's a great way to look at the world.
And when I hear you talking about science, Luke, I think it's great. But when I was in school,
you were put off.
Oh,
yeah, you see now.
I didn't even do a science my leaving cert, and I really regret it now.
Yeah, it's
something
funny,
that
isn't
I do
it?
Find
yeah.
really interesting, especially with all the crew and work being really interested
yeah.
in science and ag science. But like, it was something I couldn't get interested in school at all.
Well, you can be lucky or you can be unlucky. I mean, I had a great teacher in school in biology, for instance, and maybe that's what got me going.
Yeah,
because teachers are so important, aren't they? We all remember
yeah.
the teacher that inspired us. So, but it's so important, and the general idea would be, get science out there to young people, make it interesting, make it sort of a thing that's important, and then maybe they'll become scientists. Now, even if they don't, I think the reason why you have science in school is not to make everybody scientists, is to allow people to look at science, you know, in an informed way. So, for example, the vaccination thing, right? You can decide yourself, should I take the vaccine? Look at the data yourself, you know. So if you train people in how, what it is to be a scientist, that can inform them, you know, and help them in a way. And that's why it's so important to have it. And we're lucky in Ireland, I think, to be honest. I mean, compared to other countries, there's a good level of scientific literacy, because the education system, you do science up until you're 15, and even though you might have hated it, a bit of it stuck with you. You know, you can read something in the paper and go, oh, that doesn't look right. I'm not going to drink that bottle of snake oil. You know, whatever it is. You know, so there's a certain amount of truth in that as well, I think. And then, but that's the broader mission.
Yeah.
But then it's great if we can get some people to decide to do science anyway. Because we need scientists, you know.
Do we have a lot of opportunities in the kind of STEM and R&D areas?
We do, yeah. Well, we certainly do, like in production, for instance. I mean, 9 out of the top 10 drug companies are based in Ireland, which is fantastic. And they employ an awful lot of people, you know. And then beyond that, into the research area, the universities, there's all lots of research going on in companies as well. So there's no doubt it's a great career option. Because even if you don't become a scientist, if you have a science degree, that's a very valuable thing to have. You can get into any... You can get into business, but people like having that as a degree on a CV, you see, because science is very rigorous, you know, and it means you can master complicated things, it means you can read data, you know, and that data can be from anything. It can be a business analyst as well as a scientific analyst. I think a science degree is always useful to have anyway, for any career, really.
And have you always been able to make science so relatable and kind of break it down in different ways for people?
I've had it as a thing to do, I suppose. Yeah, it's something. I mean, it begins with teaching and lecturing and stuff, and I always enjoyed that. And then I began to do stuff with the general public. And then, if I was no good, they wouldn't ask me back. Let's put it that way, you know. So, I suppose, because they can be lazy journalists.
Yeah.
I hate to knock journalists, but my phone is hopping every day, because they can rely on me to give the one liner. Or like RTE come in at least once a week. You'll see me giving a one liner to Fergal or these guys, because they want someone to say something. So, and it's a real privilege as well, by the way. I mean, why wouldn't I love doing this? I mean, I want to tell people about this. That's my thing. And I've said to people before, like, I'm a huge Beatles fan, for instance. I'd love talking about them as well.
Yeah.
just because I'm talking about science doesn't mean I'm not interested in different.
You wouldn't mind a music radio show or something like
that. No, that's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. And the mission then is very simple in a way. And now with COVID, I mean, good God, it's... so important, isn't it? And people do, there's very good feedback. I mean, more than yourself, I imagine, you get the haters coming at you and the trolls, yeah. but the vast majority say, thanks very much. Yeah. You know, and that's gratifying. Yeah. Isn't it nice when you there'd be no point in me doing it if it wasn't working.
Yes,
in that sense, you know, so that makes it a bit easier that people actually say, look, you're doing a good job there.
I was listening to your podcast during the week, Luke, and I was listening to one of the first ones you did about the science of love.
Yeah.
I suppose a Valentine's Day coming up might be something we touch on, if that's okay.
Yes.
And it's very interesting to hear it and to listen to it, because I would have always been of the opinion, like, love is such a nonsensical kind of a thing, that how could there even be science behind it? But there is.
Oh, there absolutely there is. Yeah. Exactly. We are machines, you see. We're chemical machines.
Does science
underpin
everything? Is that a fair statement to make?
Absolutely. Yeah. See, the thing is, you can look at anything through the prism of science in a way. And the reason why science is so important for me and for us scientists is it's based on data.
Yeah.
In other words, if you say to me, I've got a drug that's going to cure your arthritis, I'm going to go, show me the evidence for that, okay? And I'm going to use my scientific training to look at the data, look at the statistics, look at the evidence, you know, and then I'm comfortable with that, and I'll take the drug, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So that kind of, and that applies to every walk. Some things you can't pin down through science, I suppose, you know, and the more complicated things. And the reason why it's difficult is we've not enough data to get our heads around these things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, love, we know, your body makes all these hormones when you fall in love. You can measure them, you know. So there's one called oxytocin, and that's like a bonding hormone, for instance, you know. So you can look, at love if you want to, through science. Now, of course, some people don't like it. They say, oh, look, it's, you're taking the magic away, you know, this kind of thing. And Isaac Newton is a famous scientist. He explained what a rainbow is. It's light is refracting into the seven colours, and he explained it that way, you know. And a poet called William Blake said he's unweaving the rainbow, is how he put it. In other words, you're losing some of the magic. So people sometimes say, oh, well, hang on a minute. But I love the fact you can use science to wonder. For some reason, it gives me more, what's the word?
Solace.
Well, solace, yeah.
I get a bit more solace thinking that there was some kind of a chemical reaction behind all these crazy things that happened.
That's
you
the point
love.
I'm making. It gives you more comfort, maybe.
Yeah.
It certainly gives it a bit of meaning, you know, that kind of thing, you know. So I love it because it's another thing to use. It's no different to other things. Science is just another thing we do as humans, you know.
Yeah.
It's special because it gives you data and evidence, really, you know, that's robust. And in science, we love things to be what's called reproducible. So if I make a discovery in my lab and I publish it, I'm only happy when someone in Japan or China gets the exact same thing. In other words, it could be due to the Liffey water or something, you know, but it's a universal. And then that's the big joy. I've had that happen to me now a few times in my career, where we've made a discovery, which is true. You know, and isn't that wonderful? And nobody can question it.
Yeah.
There's the evidence. If you do question it, it means you don't understand the data, or you're trying to be like conspiracy theorists. They're a fascination to me because they rarely have data.
Yes.
You know?
And I feel.
Yeah, like there's a double-decker bus on Mars. Is there? Oh, show it to me. Show me the evidence, I believe you. Know?
Yeah.
So it's that kind of thing, in a sense. You know. So science, in fact, science was invented in some ways in the 1600s to counter, you know, nonsense, shall we say. It was like the oldest scientific society in the world is called the Royal Society, which I happen to be a fellow of at Abbey. Now, to get this is a big deal. It's very rare.
And congratulations.
And Robert Boyle, who was... Have you heard of Boyle's Law?
No.
You must have heard of Boyle.
Is he Mass Common?
No, Boyle's Law is a famous law in chemistry. He was a famous scientist. He was a founder of the... Their motto was, take nobody's word.
Okay.
And that was in 1660. As long ago as that, they said, that's our motto. And that is exactly what science is. In other words, show me the data or shut up. Okay, that's the way to think of it. So if I go to a scientific conference and I say something, they go, where's your data to back that up? Otherwise, stop talking. You know. So that captures the essence of what science is, you see.
And look, I suppose in terms of kind of, people really obviously like the way how you make science relatable, but also how positive you are. You know,
yes.
You know, you have that positive, have you always been like that, but positive kind
I'm
of...
I'm faking
person?
It. No, that's just... Well, I think it's partly my disposition. We're all a bit different, aren't we? You know?
Yeah.
But it's also, to be a scientist, you have to be optimistic.
Okay.
And the reason is your experiments are usually failing. Because your idea is wrong, or you can't prove it, or the machine breaks down, or whatever it is, you get back up on the horse again. The most successful scientists have the capacity to bounce back from stuff not working out for you. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if science was easy, we'd have discovered a cure for cancer, remember? It's very difficult.
Okay.
So you have to have that sense of hope, I suppose, that if I have a new idea, or I'll change my idea now. In other words, I've tried it. It is tried and error to some extent, and now I'm going to go again, you know.
Yeah.
So I suspect that's where the optimism comes from. And with this one, I knew from the very start, and science would beat it, And I could say that because I know all the scientists, I know all the companies, I know they're working very hard. The brightest and best people in the world are trying to get a vaccine or a treatment. And I knew they'd win. It was only a question of when. It was never a question of if, you know, it must be so. Is that you or me? That's you. But it was never a question of if. I always had full faith. Now, of course, there are bad days, and we all have them. And I look at the media, oh, Jesus, this new variant, and this, that, and the other. You go, oh, God. So it's not all happy clappy. And I try to be realistic with people. So look, I'd say I don't know. Now, it's quite hard for a scientist to say that they don't know something because they're admitting to kind of a don't know. Yeah. But I always do that. I say, don't know. And I say, this might be the case, or we're worried about this, there's concern. I use that word sometimes. But I think what's very important when you communicate science, especially now, is to be very careful with your phrasing, because otherwise the people you're talking to either will stop listening or they'll be so in despair they'll just get nothing out of it, you know. And I always try and give, look, it's bad here, but it might get better there. That kind of a way to do it is it seems to be sensible, because otherwise, you know, you're just going to upset people in a way, you know?
And growing up, did you want to be a scientist? Was it always kind of a goal of yours from when you were younger? Or
I think I did, yeah.
I mean, rock star or anything of any sort?
Well, of course, when I was 15, yeah. I suppose I always was interested in the natural world. Let's put it that way. Remember, I grew up in Bray in Wicklow, you know, and we used to go hiking up in the Wicklow Mountains. And I remember vividly at the age of 12 or 13, how did these mountains get created, or what was about this? And I read about that 10,000 years ago they were covered in ice. So that's cool.
Yeah.
And those valleys were carved with massive glaciers. Remember that vividly. And I remember as well, one day wondering where talcum powder came from. Did you ever worry that?
No, never.
I said, what is this stuff? You shake it out, it's all lovely, you know. And that was a type of rock, and I looked it up, went to the library. There was no Google in those days, you know. And talc is a type of rock that's crushed into the. That got me, you know, for
never
example.
Never would have known that.
It's funny, yeah. So I suppose I must have been questioning the natural world, I suppose. I'm wondering about it. I mean, science really is about just asking, having the temerity to say, where are those stars, and why are they so far away, and where do they come from, and that kind of thing. So that was always part of me. But in school, I was better at English.
Were you?
That was my favourite subject, was English in school. So it wasn't all science, you know?
Yeah.
And science then began to sort of dominate. And again, it was this biology teacher when I was in fifth year doing biology for the leave. His name was Fran Mooney, right?
And did you go to school in Bray?
I did indeed. Went to Pres Bray, and he was the coolest guy. He was like 26. I think we were his first class. His hair was down to here. He'd torn jeans, you know. Our nickname for him was Shaggy. Did you ever see Scooby Doo?
Yeah.
Go for that. He looked like Shaggy slouching, you know. And when he got, now this is a bit controversial, but I went to a Catholic school, obviously, and every class was started with a prayer. He said, we're not doing that. This is a science class. You know?
Yeah.
Good on you, Fran.
Yeah.
So you need mentors, and you need people to inspire you, really, especially when you're a teenager. I think it's extremely important, you know. And that, like everybody, I'm sure if I was asked you could name an inspirational teacher, could you, when you were in school?
Oh, yeah, completely.
So we're all on the same
page.
I
like somebody studying them really, like, just because the teachers were great.
I'm saying,
like,
to
economics.
Yeah,
I loved economics, my teacher was brilliant.
Yeah, well,
I don't know if I'd actually have a disposition towards it at all.
This is what
I'm
saying to you.
Yeah.
And someone else in your class probably didn't like that teacher. It's very personal,
it
in a way, you know.
You kind
and the great line is, it can be the singer, not the song. Right? So in other words, if you're the right singer, yeah, the song sounds great, you know. And that's what teaching is, in essence. You know? So definitely, that's when it began for me, I suppose. You know?
And do you think it was that experience in fifth year kind of that pushed you towards doing a degree in science?
Oh, definitely,
would you have done it anyway?
Well, I was going to do medicine, actually, you know, because that might be a good, get a job out of it, and they're quite like biology and stuff. And didn't they change my mind between the what was called the intercert in those days and the leave, and you're gonna be same with the CAO, changed my science.
Yeah.
Much to my mother's annoyance, because she thought, and I would have got enough points in the mocks to get into medicine as well. You know?
Okay.
And then I got into science. I think I probably realised on medicine it's going to take too long to get a medical degree, and I was leaning towards being a scientist actually even then. And then I came in here, Trinity, and then you begin to specialise. And I wanted.
And you did your undergrad in.
I did, and I became obsessed then with the what you might call it, the mechanics of living systems. Like, what are the chemicals that make up life? And then I did biochemistry. That's the science of the chemistry of life, you see. But then I finished, and my fourth year project during my degree, everybody does a little research project, was on Crohn's disease. And that got my imagination. This is a disease. We don't know what causes it. We knew it was inflammation. Even then, it was inflammatory, you know. And then my PhD was in inflammation. And then that was it. I was off and running there, you know. But even then, even during, I went to London to do my PhD.
Where in London?
I was in the Royal College of Surgeons in London. And even then, I'm thinking, I might do business or get out of this. Yeah. In other words, it's sort of a stepwise process. Yeah. But then I think the big turning point for me was for definite, when you make a discovery. Because then you suddenly go, wow.
When did you make my PhD.
Of,
okay, you had a breakthrough.
I did. Yeah, but to get a PhD, you have to make a discovery. And then I remember vividly that day, you know, and then I go, oh, this is good now. So what that means is you're seeing something that no one has ever, ever seen before in the history of the world.
And it's a great buzz, kind of a huge
buzz
with that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're working hard, first of all. Yeah. So to make it gives you satisfaction. But can you imagine that no one has ever seen that before and you're the first person to see it, right? And I went, wow, this is great. Yeah, that wasn't a big thing. It was something quite small. And then I was hooked for life. And then I went to Cambridge next to do what's called a postdoc. So your first job as a PhD, by the way, is a training to be a scientist, really. Like an apprenticeship, you know. And then I did a postdoc. That was my first real job as a real jobbing scientist. You know? And then I made another discovery, you know. And I go, this is getting better now. Mm-hmm. And then the big thing about this is scientists can be satisfied with making a discovery and that's enough for them. So astronomers, who cares if that star is 50 million miles away, you know? For me, I needed something more than just the joy of discovery. And it's trying to make a new medicine, trying to discover a treatment for diseases. That became the next big thing for me. You know? And then my research was always like that from then on, you know?
So there's purpose there in it for you.
Yeah, yeah, well, I suppose the ultimate dream is that you're going to benefit humanity, I suppose, in the broadest sense. But if your discoveries can make a difference to people, then that's even more important, you know? So in essence, that was the final piece in the puzzle then for me was I'm going to stick at this. You're going to keep going, you know?
Yeah.
And what brought you back to Trinity, Luke?
Well, then I had to get a job. The way the world of science works is you're on contract for a while, right? And you can do, these are called postdoctoral fellowships. You're called a postdoc is your title. That means postdoctorate. And you can do those forever. Friends of mine are still doing them. 3 years here, anywhere in the world.
Does that mean you get to stay in college forever?
Well, that's the other question. There's two.
That sounds good to me.
Well, no, you see, what people don't get it. This is what always gets me about universities. Teaching is a small part of our job. We're mainly in research.
Okay.
Now, where is research done in the world? It's done in universities. It's done in research institutes, which just do research alone. Chagosk being a good case in point. You know, some of those are funded by governments. Some are funded by drug companies. You can go and work for a company and do research. You know, so in the end, as a postdoc, you can get a job in any of those places. Yeah. So in Cambridge, I was in a research institute connected to the university. You know, now finally, then had to get a job, and I knew I wanted to teach as well as do research. You see. And then I applied, and then I got a job here. Now, I could have gone to America. I was offered a job in Southampton, for instance, you know. But in the end, I took the job here, and then I came back here, right? Now, my boss in Cambridge said, "You're a bloody idiot taking that job." He says, "That's a backwater." Because Ireland wasn't famous for research in those days.
And yeah.
Trinity was okay, but it wasn't like world class. He said, "You should be going to America. You should be playing for Man United," or whatever the equivalent is, you know. So,
and what was Trinity if America was?
Jesus, I'd say we were... Shamrock Rovers. Not quite. So I came back here then, and that almost gave me an extra sort of motivation. I'll show you, you know.
Yeah.
And he says to me, Luke, he says, "If it doesn't work out, you can come back to me anyway." Sort of safety net. That was quite nice of him. But I came back, and then I began building my lab. Ireland began to change then. There was more investment in research, which is, you need money, you know.
Yeah.
So Science Foundation Ireland came along, and they were very supportive to me. They gave me loads of grants. Because without money, you can't recruit the team. It is like a football team. I'm the manager. Basically, you know, and my job is to find the players. And if you've got money, you can bring in some of the best players, I suppose. And then you need to have a reputation. Like, nobody, like a fantastic player is not going to go and play for Shamrock Rovers, is he? Because he feels like I should be on the world stage here, you know. So you need to be, if you haven't got that reputation, you won't attract the great players either, you know. So it's funny, isn't it? It's very, the analogy is quite good.
I like it.
And it's true, it's very true.
Yeah.
And of course, you can have the giant killers. And we were that for a while, but then we got bigger. Now immunology in Ireland now is it's number one in the world by some metrics, you know.
Yeah.
So and that was because of inward investment from the government had to support that, you know. So it's a funny way to describe it, but it's true, you know.
And look, on the opposite kind of end of the spectrum to science is kind of music, or is it? You know what I mean? Your interest in music is, well, do people find that strange, I suppose, that you have that interest in music, or for you, do they marry well together?
Scientists don't, because often scientists are creative. This is another strange myth.
Yeah.
Many of my scientific friends are musicians or artists or whatever it is, because they're quite rounded people in a way, you know. And we all have a hobby, don't we? And I'm sure you've got hobbies as well. So for me, music was the big hobby from when I was a teenager. Now, I would go to conferences, and there'd always be a dinner at the end of the conference, and you'd have like there'd be a disco or something just to get, you know. And then often we would get up and play, me and my fellow scientists, get a few guitars out and entertain the delegates and all that, you know. So it's very common. Like, it's not that unusual. At least in science, it's not unusual.
Yeah.
The general thing, you know, the people say to me, how can you be a musician and a scientist? That's ridiculous. They're seen as completely opposite things in a way. But as I said, among scientists, it wouldn't be that strange to be doing it. Let's put it that way, you know. And then I began doing it. And then I was in bands over the years. In fact, when I was in Cambridge, as a postdoc, I was in a band. Doing pub gigs and stuff, you know, and we were offered a tour of Europe. Can you believe it? Like,
what was the name of the band?
We were called the Sleeping Arrangements. And the reason for that was because we used to do covers. You know, I've always been in a band that's like a wedding band type thing. Yeah. Like, I don't write my own stuff because that's a bit too pretentious, shall we say? Yeah. And we'd arrange the music, you see. So, and when I was living in England, and you'd come back to Ireland. And you might bring your girlfriend or boyfriend back with you. And your mother would always go, what are the sleeping arrangements? Remember that? Did you ever ask that question? Yeah. Let's get the sleeping arrangements. Yeah, we're not having any messing here now on my roof. So the name was partly inspired by that, because there was Irish guys in the band. They could all relate to the idea of the sleeping arrangements. But famously, we were literally offered a tour around Europe once.
And right? You never took it?
And I said no. And of course, half the guys were on the dole, you know, and you bastards, we wanted to go, and you said no. And I said no because I just made a big discovery in the lab, and I realised if I leave that now, that's a missed opportunity, you know. So I said no. Now, if I said yes, I may never come back. And then, like, maybe music's gain would have been science's loss, or the opposite, or whatever it is. But the music has always been there, and it's a great distraction, isn't it? Let's face it, it's so different to science. Although music can be very mathematical, you know, the chord changes and stuff. So the overlap between music and science isn't as unusual as you might think, in a way, you know, because they do have a lot of things in common.
And you happy with your decision not to go on the tour that time and go to science route?
I'm kicking myself now. Yeah, I should have gone on tour, shouldn't I? You know, because that would have been great fun.
Well, you'd be out of work now if you're a musician, so.
Well, that's very true, yeah. Precisely. And another little part of this was, so in 2017, I think I mentioned it already, I was asked to organise a huge immunology congress in Dublin. 1,000 people came to the RDS, can you believe it, in immunology. Now, you wouldn't have even heard of it, would you? If they came now, they'd be kings, wouldn't they? You know, queen. And we organised.
Can
you imagine? Yeah. So we organised the conference, and I was one of the organisers. And then the overall organising body were called Keystone. They were the name of the conference. They said, Luke, it's in Dublin. Put a band together to entertain the crowd. They knew I was doing this. Anyway. So yeah. I did. I put a band together. And we played that gig, and there must have been 600 people in the audience, and it was great fun. And in fact, I'll show you a photograph. Here it is. Let me show you. I gave you this as a souvenir. Look at this.
Is he playing at the conference?
That's us at the conference right now.
What's it say in your t-shirts?
We're called the Metabolics, as you know. Oh, yeah. And I came up with that name for that conference because the conference was about immunometabolism, so the word was good. And now I'll give you these guys. So he's got a PhD in chemistry. She's got a PhD in immunology. Colin, he's the chief neonatologist in Hollis Street. The drummer who you can't quite see. There's Brian, if you see him up here. Brian, he is a neurologist in Beaumont. Okay? Wow. So it's a mixture of scientists and medics, amazing. Basically. Now, I wasn't stupid, and I realised we're good, but we're not great. While we're rehearsing, okay? And Brian, the drummer, his son was being taught guitar by this guy, Chris Cole. You see him there?
Yeah.
There he is beside me, Chris Cole. Now, he is a genius guitarist. He's a professional musician. And he's in loads of bands. And he came to rehearsal, and the sun came out because he played. And then we all thought, man alive, where are you? We love you because he's brilliant. So he was a professional. Now, he lifted it because he was brilliant. Right?
This woman, the electric guitar,
he's a lead guitarist. This woman is a singer, and she was in bands, and she was brilliant. She's the niece of Colm, so that was the connection there, you know. And then, so we had two professionals in the lineup. Now, they made a big difference.
Yeah.
Now, we did the gig, right? And then, I went, good, you know. Now, I thought it was a one-off. But then we got offered to play at Body and Soul. Now, they asked me to take part in a kind of sciencey discussion. They have a sciencey discussion thing. Bring the band. We did Body and Soul. That this is good now. Now, I was sure Chris Cole, our guitarist, would dump us pretty quickly because he's a professional. Oh, no, he says, I like this now because it's easy for me because I'm much better than you guys. And then we got offered a gig in a pub in Dalkey called the Dalkey Duck. And we did that. And then they said, we want you every month, once a month. Because we get the crowd
there. Yeah.
The mission of the Metabolics is quite simple, and it's to make people happy.
Okay.
And my dream was it'd be a miserable Friday night, and the people are there, they've had a hard week at work, and they're pissed off with their boss, and we lift them out of it by playing Rolling Stones or the Beatles or whatever.
Yeah.
And the great guideline for our set list. Now, bands can fall out a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Is if you hear the first 5 seconds, you want to get up and dance. That like Dancing Queen, we don't play that one, but that kind of idea, you know. So then we must have done about 50, 60 gigs at this stage. We did loads of conferences. They flew the Metabolics to a conference in Boston. They flew us to Australia. Now, because I give a talk, they get two for the price of one with me. So that's the story. And then of course, our last gig was back in March last year. We were asked to go to Tanzania. Now, wait to hear this one. So one of the guys in the band, one of his mates, they all did medicine together in UCD.
Yeah.
One of his mates is a woman. Her name is Trish Scanlon. She works in Dar es Salaam. And she has a charity to provide drugs for kids with cancer. And she asked us to play a fundraiser for them in Tanzania to raise money for her charity. It was a St. Paddy's Day gig with all the expats living there. And the Irish ambassador got involved. He booked us to do two more gigs. The trip was paid for by these gigs we did for the embassy, basically, you know. And then we went and we did a gig in Tanzania. Isn't that amazing?
That was your last gig.
The next gig
you do, I'm going to be in the front row. The front row.
But wait, this bit. So the week before we go to Tanzania, we did a gig in the Docky Duck to raise money for the charity. Okay, and we raised $2,500 that night, which was brilliant. Kira Kelly, do you know her? She's in New Zealand. She sings in the Metabolics. She caught COVID that night.
Dr. Kira Kelly.
That was the night.
Now, so here's the full story. We fly to Tanzania maybe 4 days after the gig in the Docky Duck. We're in Tanzania, we do the gig. I get a message from one of my mates saying, Luke, 6 people have tested positive in the Docky Duck. Now, what did I do? And I immediately booked flights and had to leave Tanzania because that was where we were all infected.
Yeah.
We flew back the next day. We didn't even see Tanzania because there was a risk of infection. So we flew back immediately. We didn't want to be spreading this virus.
Yeah,
so
you never got to the gig in Tanzania?
We managed to do the gig.
We managed to do the gig and then came back.
It was after the gig I got the message that the virus was in the Docky Duck that night. So we had to come back quickly. Isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
And we flew back and we were miserable. I mean, can you imagine flying back? It was awful, you know. But I said it was the safest thing to do because I knew. Now, none of any symptoms.
Yeah.
But I knew that this virus could spread with no symptoms at that stage. So she's get out because.
Yeah, you were, yeah.
That was a sad thing.
That's a big decision to make as well.
Oh, well, I had to book 6 flights. Now, guess who had to pay for those? It cost me $6,000 to fly back for the van.
Jesus.
But the thing was, the other thing to say is we've done 2 more things with the Metabolics since this gig. So, Brezzy, do you know him?
Yeah.
He interviewed me for his podcast and he said, bring the band along. And we recorded 3 songs. And if you listen to Where Is My Mind, the Christmas one, the Metabolics play 3 songs. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And we could record them socially distanced in his studio. You see.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then the last one was, I gave a talk for all the GPs of Ireland in December the 15th, I think it was. And I knew, let's bring the band and play a song for them. So we did. So I did the interview with all the and like 1,000 GPs tuned in for
them. Yeah.
And then we played Merry COVID Christmas. We rearranged the words Merry Christmas, everybody. So that was, and you can hear it if you go on the GP site, we played that as well. So it was great fun.
And
it was good to have the band back together, kind of thing. Now, the musicians, the professionals, have been out of work. I mean, it's devastating. We know this in spades, but good God, they're on their knees. I mean, no gigs. Yeah. Chris would play weddings a lot.
Yeah.
No weddings. And that was a bit of an earner for them, but they got better pay money for weddings.
Yeah.
So it's terrible. You know, they're as eager as anybody else to try to get things back to some kind of situation where gigs will happen again.
Yeah. We'll all be looking forward to
it. It's that creative thing as well, isn't it? Not being able to sing. Not being able to do what you want to do.
Well, some of them teach by Zoom and stuff, but it's still miserable.
That's not the same.
Yeah.
In fact, the bass player, who's a professional, he turned up to play at the Brezzy thing. He said, Luke, I got blisters on my fingers practicing. He hadn't played the bass in 3 months.
Jesus.
And he's already got blisters. So just, it's terrible, isn't it, for these?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the last part about the music, what I'm added on is playing with Mundy. Did you see that now on New Year's Eve?
Yes.
Now, that was wild. Like,
that's Mundy is fantastic, though.
If you told me a year before this that next New Year's Eve you'll be on stage in the Gaiety Theatre playing with Mundy and Sharon Shannon, with nobody in the audience. What the
you wouldn't even comprehend it, that it would
like,
be true.
I reckon the odds of that were like 10 billion to 1. It's just ridiculous, you know, to do that. But that was brilliant because Mundy, he asked me to do it with him. And he said, let's sing this song, Mexico, because it's about, you know, healing bright weather.
Yeah.
And so I said, fantastic, I'll do that. So it was great. That was really good fun. But to me, that captures the whole ridiculous, surreal nature of COVID-19, doesn't it? That single moment.
I always say that, like, if you said a year ago or even before, it's even at the start of last year, what we'd be like now, you'd be like, that's like that movie Contagion, which I'd like to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But in 5 years' time, right, we'll look back, and hopefully, obviously, we'll be on the back end, we'll be going, that's bananas.
Exactly.
It wasn't as bad as that, was it?
Yeah.
And really,
well, the other great gig at Monday in 5 years.
Absolutely. Well, no, my dream, what I'm looking forward to is this. That's a big thing. Look forward to something.
Yeah.
Keep your mental health somewhat intact. Is they should, and this has been suggested now in Brussels, there should be concerts all over the world when we get out of this.
Yeah.
And every country could host a concert, and then you might have a Live Aid type thing, which would raise money for the people who've been devastated by this.
And you'll surely be playing at our concert anyway, Lou, whenever it is.
Can you imagine what this set list would be? Britain, Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah.
All those very positive songs.
Yeah. It'd be
great.
It'd be an incredible thing. It's actually a great thing to do.
It's a great idea. Yeah.
It's the one thing that I miss, and I said to my wife, she's asked, what do you miss before?
Yeah.
And it's concerts. And I skipped so many. My friends would be going. And
I was thinking of the gigs, all the nights I didn't go to a gig in Whelan's when I was asked or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
I was thinking, why would you do that? I will never skip one again. It's Wednesday. No, of course I can't.
I think what's happened is we've learned why these things matter.
Now
it's a bit of a truism, we took things for granted, but it's very true. Why is music important to us? Now we never had to ask that because we just did it and enjoyed it and didn't really think about it. But now we know it's essential for us as a species. I guess we invented music. There's a chap, I talk about the science of music as well, by the way, on the podcast. Well,
the mammoth bone was the first one.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, but we invented music kind of as a way to help us, as a way to but to get together, to have a convivial thing, but also just there's something going on there for our well-being in a way, isn't it? So I think it's important to remember that too. Same with theatre and the arts. I mean, we've learned however, we know science is important, don't we? And science is the way out of this, but equally the arts are extremely important to us.
Absolutely, for sure.
We'll get back to them soon.
We will. We will. It's just, as I say, it's when, not if.
The Irish Country Living Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.